Next up on This Week in Law, Sarah Pearson, Shubha Ghosh, Andrew Gilden, and I discuss lots of interesting things this week. We're going to talk about those SpaceX photos. Are they really in the public domain? We'll talk about fair use for the rich and fabulous, a novel free speech argument attempted by Pandora, good flags, bad flags, and much more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
It's time for TWiT's annual audience survey, and we want to hear from you. Please visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It only takes a few minutes, and your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. We thank you so much for your continued support. twit.tv/survey.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 297, recorded March 27, 2015. Copyright or sticky tape? This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Nitro. Nitro accelerates the way businesses create, prepare, and sign PDF files anytime, anywhere, saving you and your business time. To learn more and try it free for 14 days, visit gonitro.com/twit. That's gonitro.com/twit. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by FreshBooks, the easy-to-use invoicing software perfect for your law firm and designed to help small business owners save time billing and get paid faster. Join over 5 million users running their business with ease. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/twill. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Welcome back. We were on a break last week, but we're thrilled to be back at it this week on This Week in Law. We've got a fantastic panel. As usual, we bring you some of the brightest people in the land to discuss and ponder the thorny issues at the intersection of technology and law. Before we introduce you to our illustrious guests, I'm going to introduce you once again and welcome back to the show my co-host, Sarah Pearson. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, Denise. How are you?
Glad to be here. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
Did you have a good week?
Yeah, I did. I was at the University of Minnesota working on a OER project up there in the beginning of the week, so that was kind of fun.
Oh, great. And we have good Creative Commons-related stuff that's been going on since we took a hiatus between now and our last show. For those who haven't been following along too closely at home, Sarah is counsel to Creative Commons. And if you're not familiar with what Creative Commons is, we're going to talk a bit about that, quite a bit about that actually in the show today. So before we get to all that, we'll introduce you to our two panelists today. Today joining us, we have Andrew Gilden, who is a research fellow at Stanford. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Denise. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. Tell us about the interesting work you're doing at Stanford.
Sure. So my research mostly looks at intellectual property and internet law, and I'm particularly interested in questions of creativity, expression, and identity development, which covers a broad range of law and tech issues.
It sure does. All right. Well, we're going to get into a lot of that in the show today. But we're going to do so along with yet another illustrious academic guest, Shubha Ghosh from the University of Wisconsin. Hello, Shubha.
Yeah, hi, Denise. Thanks for having me on.
It's wonderful to have you on, and congratulations to the Badgers for making it to the Elite Eight.
Yep, I'm happy. You can tell from my picture.
Yes, exactly. Shubha is in a technical situation where he's not able to join us by video, but we're happy to have you with us live, and we're happy to just chat with you in whatever way that we can. I'm sure the atmosphere around campus is pretty giddy right now.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I'm in Washington, D.C. this year on sabbatical, so I've been enjoying it from a distance. But it's pretty giddy. So
good. Well, no wonder you're able to do things like attend Supreme Court oral arguments. That's very convenient.
But attend some next week. Yeah, just down the block from where I'm working. Yeah.
Perfect. All right. Well, we're going to discuss a broad range of things today, and we're going to start things on the copyright front. All right, Sarah, I think we'll get into one of these Creative Commons related topics right away with SpaceX and the sort of strange saga that ensued when Elon Musk made a bunch of available photos, put a bunch of available photos on Flickr and licensed them with the available Creative Commons licenses that Flickr uses. But then got called out by someone on Twitter who said, "Hey, Elon, why don't you go ahead and put these things in the public domain? Why just use a Creative Commons license?" And Elon Musk tweeted back that, "Hey, that sounds like a great idea. The pictures are now in the public domain." But does that really get him where he needs to go, Sarah?
So, yeah, that was kind of a fascinating twist to me, that it was just some random person on Twitter that kind of prompted this pretty big change. But no, yeah, the question of whether just saying in a tweet the photos are in the public domain, that's definitely debatable. But I think so now what's happened in the few days following is that the photos are now actually up on Wikimedia Commons under CC0, which is our public domain dedication tool. So part of the problem was Flickr doesn't actually integrate CC0 capabilities. So they only have the 6 regular CC licenses, and they don't have the public domain dedication. Although we're hoping to kind of work on them through this, you know, because what happened is they ended up losing the photos. The photos, maybe they're still on Flickr too, but now the photos are also up on Wikimedia Commons just because they wanted access to the CC0 tool. So that's kind of the history of what happened so far, at least. And it's probably kind of a continuing story in some ways, to the extent that Flickr changes what they're doing.
Well, how does it work if they are still up on Flickr and we have, you know, attached to them there one kind of license, and they're up on Wikimedia where people can see that they have the CC0 license attached to them? Do you see that being a problem?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly confusing. All CC licenses are non-exclusive, so you could technically put, you know, 6 different CC licenses on your work, and people have access to use under the terms of any of them or any of the ones that they're a licensee to, which just means if they got the work on Wikimedia Commons, then they could rely on CC0. If they got the work under Flickr, they could, I guess, technically... That would be questionable. I would think that they would also, you know, they're in the public domain now, so you wouldn't have to comply with the license that it says on Flickr. But it's definitely confusing, for sure.
Right. As a practical matter, nobody's going, as long as Elon and friends are comfortable that they want the works out there, they're not going to be enforcing, even if they have a slightly more restrictive license on Flickr, correct?
That's right. And I think, I'm not certain, but I don't even know if they say who the photographer is. So it'd be interesting, you know, who would people even attribute if they were going to use the photo? And lots of times when photos are in the public domain, you still try to, you know, give attribution, even though it's not legally required, but just because it's a best practice. But it'd be interesting. I don't think that the photographer has actually been named. I'm not certain of that. But
right.
One other thing.
Go ahead, sir.
I was just going to say one other thing. One of the links in the show notes had a talk about whether or not you can really dedicate a work to the public domain, and kind of an interesting discussion about the CC0 tool and its potential limitations. And I think it's interesting. But the way that CC0 was created, which was long before my time, so I can't take credit for it, but it's pretty ingenious because, you know, understanding that not every jurisdiction allows you to affirmatively put works in the public domain, it has a fallback, a couple of different fallbacks. So one is, if the waiver doesn't work, then CC0 just acts as a license to do anything that you want with the work with no conditions. And if for some reason that's held unenforceable, it's also a non-assert promise, basically, by the person that's applying the CC0 tool. So it has a couple of different mechanisms to try to deal with jurisdictions that don't, unlike the U.S., where I think there is binding authority, or not binding authority, but there are cases that say that you can dedicate something to the public domain here, but I think it's not the case everywhere in the world. So,
Shuba, do you have any thoughts on that, other than the fact that this whole episode seems to give you a lot of fodder for a copyright exam, for example?
Well, I try to think beyond that, but yeah, I know it's a really interesting development. You know, just to comment on things outside the U.S., I would worry about moral rights issues, especially on the attribution and some of the other things. Moral rights, especially outside the U.S., tends to have its own logic to it, separate from copyright. And so I'm not completely clear to me how the Creative Commons license works for that. I think there are aspects of the license that can deal with that, but that certainly would be a concern, you know, outside the U.S. But, you know, copyright is, you know, of the different IP regimes, it's the most like sticky tape. It really is hard to get rid of, you know, short of just simply, you know, not enforcing. But that, you know, requires a lot of forbearance by whoever the copyright owner might be. But it seems like the Creative Commons license is certainly a positive, you know, step on this. And you know, you're probably fairly accurate in saying that these images are in the public domain, though, you know, how stable that domain is going to be is left to be seen.
Shuba, sure. Can you explain for any of our listeners who aren't lawyers, and I'm sure there are plenty who are not, what the difference is between copyrights and moral rights?
Oh, yeah, sure. So copyrights deal with, I think copyrights probably exist longer than, you know, have existed longer than moral rights. Moral rights probably is a creation of the late 19th century following a European tradition that's trying to respect the integrity of the author. It's almost like a personal right of the author in the work to keep it from being misattributed, from being destroyed, from being altered. And it really is about protecting the personality of the author as being embodied in the work. While copyright just treats the work as if it's just another commodity that can be bought and sold and is really protecting the economic interests. So they are parallel. The United States has sort of avoided moral rights until, you know, the late 1980s. I guess if you want to think about the U.S. adopting moral rights, probably 1989 when it entered into an international treaty called the Berne Convention. And in order to enter that international treaty, in order to protect its interest, U.S. interests in copyright law, the international treaty also required the U.S. to recognize these things called moral rights. And moral rights, as they exist in the U.S., are fairly narrow. I could go into more detail, but that's the big distinction between the two. A copyright deals with the economic interests, while moral rights deal with the rights of the personality of the author. So I hope that's helpful in sort of setting up that distinction.
It is. It's still confusing to me since we don't really have that principle in the U.S., right? Or did you say that we actually do?
Well, we sort of do. And I mean, this is where it gets interesting. In order to enter into the Berne Convention, you know, the U.S. had to ensure the other signatories, which were largely European countries, that it did recognize moral rights. And so in order to comply, the U.S. did alter copyright law to introduce a narrow band of moral rights for works of visual artists. And so that includes photographs. It includes, in a very narrow way, it mostly includes graphic and design works. But if you actually ask somebody in the U.S. administration at the time, their position, you know, at the international arena is that the U.S. always had a type of moral rights. So, for example, if somebody altered somebody's work, the U.S. position was, well, under U.S. law, we don't have something called moral rights, maybe in name, but we have something like defamation law.
I see.
Or in some situations, we might have some aspects of unfair competition or trademark law that protects the same sort of interests that are separate from copyright. So that's where it does get confusing. But part of the confusion is, I think, really stems from the half-hearted way that the U.S. adopted it in order to be able to sign on to the treaty. And really, it wanted to sign on to the treaty, the Berne Convention, to protect its copyright interests overseas.
Got it.
I think another... Another reason that I think it's kind of confusing for Americans is just because of the tension with the First Amendment, at least with the right of integrity. So this idea that you wouldn't be able to touch a work because of the author's, you know, this kind of romantic notion of messing with what the author's creation seems in a lot of ways, I think, is in tension with the First Amendment and kind of the way that we view things in the United States. So I think that's part of why it's a little bit uncomfortable from an American perspective.
But what's funny about that is that actually when you talk to artists about why they would want some sort of IP protection, it would be because they get attribution. Yeah. They think they get attribution, they can protect their reputation. And these are actually the things that copyright doesn't protect. So there's this interesting disconnect between kind of what the international regime provides and what kind of artists expect. So there's an interesting tension both around the First Amendment and between kind of copyright and what artists are asking for.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I assume that a big part of that is because American copyright has become more focused on the copyright holder and not the artist or author, which is, you know, it's just in tension with moral rights, which, as Shubha noted, is really about protecting the author. So I think it's kind of just seems like the way that American law has skewed in recent years.
And not to add to the confusion, but even the, you know, the freedom of expression is confusing within copyright because, I mean, usually we think about it in terms of, let's say, somebody who's making a parody or some type of derivative work, saying, well, I have the right to express myself, building on what somebody did before. But at the same time, you know, that we think about, or at least the Supreme Court has sort of talked about the free speech rights of the author. So that itself is sort of split. I mean, the rights of the author, free speech rights of the author, and also free speech rights of people who want to build on the author's work.
Right.
So that's not completely clear.
And the interesting twist of the free speech rights of potentially the intermediary.
Right.
I think we may be getting to that later in the discussion.
Yeah, exactly. Freedom of press issues and things like that. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. It's going to be author. These are phrases that we drop into the show in case you are listening in hope of getting continuing legal or other professional education credit. We do have these wonderful guests on every week who are leaders in their field on the topics that we discuss. So I think that it's a great idea to go to your MCLE oversight board and say, hey, I listened to Twill, throw a little credit my way. We have some resources for you if you are interested in doing that. If you go to wiki.twit.tv. One of our wonderful interns put together a list of all the 50 jurisdictions in the United States and how you would go about, at least for lawyers, communicating with your local bar or your state bar about getting credit for listening to the show. So that's there for you. And we will drop another phrase into the show at a later time so that you can show one of those oversight boards if you have to. Some states require this, that you actually listen to or watch the show. Let's also, since we're taking a quick break here, thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Nitro. Nitro is an amazing tool. It's the leading alternative to Adobe Acrobat. From individual users to large enterprises, Nitro gives you everything you need to easily view, create, prepare, and sign. That's really important if you're dealing with the legal aspects of things, PDF files, delivering more value through a clean UI, simple deployment options, and the best customer service in the business. Easily connect and host documents in the Nitro cloud, enabling you to securely complete transactions with legally binding e-signatures. Print to PDF from any application using the Nitro Pro virtual printer driver. Simple one-click PDF conversions to any MS Office format and back again. And you can add text anywhere on a PDF document, even if it doesn't have interactive fields for that. You have intuitive editing tools that let you manipulate text, change fonts, customize layouts, and more. And the Nitro Pro UI is based on the familiar Microsoft Office ribbon. So it's going to be very intuitive and easy for you to pick up if you're already working in that universe. You can transform any scanned document or image into a searchable and editable PDF with OCR. You can offer feedback and collaborate with others using simple markup and review tools. And Nitro Pro is used by over 500,000 businesses, including 50% of the Fortune 500. So you know this thing is well-tested and reliable. And if you haven't checked it out yet, you should. And you can do that by going to gonitro.com/twit to learn more about Nitro and their document solutions. And as a special offer for fans of this show, you can try it free for 14 days. No credit card required. Just go to gonitro.com/twit. Thank you so much, Nitro, for your support of This Week in Law. Let's talk about artists and artistic inspiration. Andrew, you've done a lot of research and given a lot of thought to the artistic process, and particularly this notion of raw materials being something that might not be subject to copyright as we think about it. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, so in the past decade or so, there's been a shift in how courts address the question about whether a use is transformative for purposes of primarily copyright fair use, but also in the right of publicity context as well. The courts have been asking is whether an artist used a pre-existing work as, quote, raw material, and if so, it is likely to be transformative. And this inquiry has really is gained steam in some well-known cases involving the artists Jeff Koons and Richard Prince. This inquiry has been celebrated because it's generally expanded the rights of authors to of artists to, you know, kind of freely copy from the world around them. What I argue in a forthcoming article is that this is a kind of a problematic way to think about the relationship between the artist and their sources. Often artists don't kind of take from the public domain or from their kind of cultural environment and take works and think of them as raw materials. They're not raw. They're actually rich with cultural meaning. There are, you know, movies, books, photographs that artists often have a very significant significant emotional connection to. And if the courts are requiring them to treat them as, quote, raw material, then again, we have this distortion between what copyright law is incentivizing and encouraging and what artists are actually doing on the ground.
Right. So tell us about Jeff Koons. I think once upon a time, a very long time ago on the show, we talked about his suit that involved making a sculpture that was based on a photograph.
Right.
And the photographer suit, it was a photograph of a couple with a bunch of puppies.
a string of adorable blue German Shepherd puppies.
Right.
Yeah. So in the early 90s, Jeff Koons lost three lawsuits that were that challenged some of his sculptures. One was he took a photograph of this couple with these German Shepherd puppies and turned them into the sculpture. Another one involved a sculpture of Odie the dog from Garfield. Another one was a photograph, I believe, of two children with a wheelbarrow. And the kind of the authors of the underlying images sued, and there was a Second Circuit case called Rogers versus Koons, where the Second Circuit said, you know, this is not fair use. Jeff Koons is not commenting about anything kind of inherent in the original, in some respects, kind of a low point in kind of artistic fair use. That was actually before the Supreme Court's kind of game-changing case in Campbell, where it said that the Two Live Crew's "Oh Pretty Woman" parody of the Roy Orbison song "Oh Pretty Woman" was transformative and brought in this idea of transformative works being fair. And flash forward to 2006. There was another case in the Second Circuit involving Jeff Koons, where he took a photograph of a woman's legs from Allure magazine and collaged them into a painting. And the Second Circuit had a completely different tune. So, you know, he was using these images as raw material. He was commenting on kind of commerciality in society generally, and that was enough. So the landscape really has changed in a way that has expanded artistic freedoms generally. But my concern, and I've written about this a bit, is that there's been some kind of unevenness in that expansion. If you're an extremely famous artist like Jeff Koons or Richard Prince, you can use all the raw materials you want. But if you are a lesser known artist, things are a little dicier. And the case law has borne that out a little bit in the last few years.
Right. And you have a wonderfully titled article on that topic called Fair Use for the Rich and Fabulous.
Yes. Which,
that, along with everything else we're discussing today, is in our discussion points at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/297 if you want to look it up and read it in its entirety. But your point there is the one you just made, that if you are Jeff Koons, you might have a better, even though he lost his case when it happened today, you would have a better chance of having your work pass fair use muster. But if you are, for example, the person who made the GIF I saw this morning that was some sort of commentary about copyright law, I was trying to find it just now as we were talking, can't find it. But it was a GIF based on My Little Pony. And I remember what it was. It was in Parker Hingen's Sarah Jong's wonderful, there it is, I just found it. So if you want to look it up too, if you go to their Five Useful Articles newsletter, which I highly recommend. I mean, they're just so funny and wonderful. And there's a gift that they feature in there with all the little ponies jumping around. And it says, all I want for my birthday are reasonable copyright terms, because they're talking about the Happy Birthday lawsuit that is going on, the Happy Birthday to You song lawsuit. So for the person who came up with that GIF, getting back to my point, they might not be in as comfortable a situation as Jeff Koons, even though they're hitting all the fair use factors, or quite a few of them, by having commentary. What they're not hitting is necessarily commenting on My Little Pony in their copyright-related GIF. Right, Andrew?
Yeah, and courts have been fairly inconsistent about whether that they require this kind of commentary in the original. So there were a few cases last year in the Central District of California where artists were taking images, photographs. It was specifically of Sid Vicious from Sex Pistols, photographs of him doing kind of Warholian takes on his work, and the court said, you're not really commenting on the original. Even though, in the Jeff Koons case, the Second Circuit didn't require such a kind of narrow requirement. So what you see happening in some of these cases is that there really are some kind of almost surprising language about, at the Richard Prince opening, there was Jay-Z and Beyonce were there, as was Anna Wintour and maybe Brad Pitt, I think, was in the list. You actually have a kind of a celebrity list from the Gagosian Gallery that comes into copyright opinions, and not everyone has access, to Jay-Z on speed dial.
No, not like you and me, Andrew. Shuba, any thoughts about this raw material doctrine and, or not doctrine, but the interplay between raw materials and fair use?
Yeah, no, I think, I think Andrew hit on a lot of the big points. I mean, part of the background, I've written a little bit about using this idea of raw material when you're looking at protection for data, but that's a completely different area, which, overlaps with privacy. And in some ways, the whole idea of something raw versus processed might work there when you're just dealing with basic, really basic underlying information that hasn't been, put through some sort of creative or other type of process. But I think Andrew's right. It's just very hard to operationalize what is transformative, and the courts are all over the place. I mean, I think 20 years ago, there's this satire versus parody distinction that came out of the Campbell case. And, you know, that distinction, that always has eluded me. I think it's eluded most people. I mean, you can articulate sort of a distinction. The court sort of says, are you commenting on the work, or are you commenting on something else outside the work? But, you know, you don't have to be very deep in literary theory to realize those boundaries between the work and what's outside the work is just, you know, pretty permeable. So I don't think that's, you know, I think it's very hard to come up with a substantive standard. I mean, the one thing I'll add to Andrew's comment, and this kind of dovetails with some things I'm working on now in other areas, is that a lot of this is really reflecting some of the problems in the, you know, in federal litigation. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it, but I will just for the sake of our discussion. But, you know, a lot of it depends upon access to good attorneys and, you know, just sort of access to justice issues more broadly. And so it'd be interesting to think about these issues from those terms to see whether there could be some alternatives to a federal system of adjudicating this, because, you know, that is just extremely costly. And I think it does favor, I forget Andrew's exact term, the rich and fabulous. Certainly the rich and possibly the fabulous. I mean, so that's the one wrinkle I would add to this. And I think that's important to keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Sarah, obviously fair use much on your mind and in your work. Anything to add?
Yeah, I first wanted to say, Andrew, this article is fascinating. I wasn't going to read the full article last night, but I did. I just got totally sucked in, and I want to spend more time with it too. So I actually have some questions for you.
Sure.
I just thought the great thing about it was it really got me kind of challenging. Like you said, I think it's easy to kind of reflexively say, of course, these opinions are good for artists. And I really liked how you kind of challenged that conventional wisdom. I guess one kind of question I came away with is, do you think that there's anything to the fact that, you know, maybe rather than it being about the defendant side and whether or not they're famous, whether it's actually about the work on the plaintiff side, so the copyrighted work that's being used, whether that is famous or not. And so what I mean by that, I guess, is, you know, I think that this idea of kind of building block versus raw material, you made a really compelling argument that we've kind of skewed more toward thinking of raw in kind of a literal sense, and it having, you know, having to devalue it and kind of strip it of value. And in some ways that makes sense for those defendants to be making that argument, because they want to try to minimize any idea that they're, or any perception that they're capitalizing on the fame of the original. So, you know, right or wrong, it kind of feels to me like that's a logical outcome, not necessarily a good one or not. But I wondered, it seemed like a lot of the examples of fair use not working in the raw material side were examples of non-famous artists using famous works, or in the publicity right sense, using famous celebrities in images. Do you feel like this also translates to situations where non-famous artists are using non-famous works as raw material? I don't know if I've articulated that very well, because I'm kind of...
Yeah, I think you're spot on that it's a lot easier to think of some guy in Jamaica who no one knows of as raw material for a famous artist like Richard Prince than it is to think of, you know, the Catcher in the Rye as raw, as sort of unworked and kind of, and ready to be transformed in a variety of different ways. So I think you're right that when it is kind of a big guy versus little guy, it's very difficult to map onto this idea that artists need to use pre-existing materials as raw material. The small guy versus small guy example, you know, I think there are a few, you know, I'm not seeing a whole lot of a trend there. I think it's actually pretty scattered. probably because I actually don't think the metaphor does a whole lot of work there. And if judges are using this raw material metaphor to make decisions, it's not going to be very helpful unless it kind of fits the mold of the romantic author who kind of purveys the raw materials of the world. And that tends to skew in one direction. So hopefully as we see fair use expanding through this inquiry, it's not going to stop here. This is just the beginning of the discussion about kind of what is the range of creative freedoms that artists need and how can courts capture that adequately.
Yeah. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more, too, about what you, how you would kind of re-envision. Because it seems to me like you're not necessarily, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so to correct me if I'm wrong, but you're not necessarily finding fault with this idea that work builds on itself and, this idea of building blocks versus, and more, it's the more the raw material aspect, the rawness that you're finding fault with. So is that correct? And also, can you talk a little bit about how you would kind of re-envision us seeing some of these transformative cases?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. An inherent part of creativity is working with what came before. But a lot of times it's not about kind of erasing the origin of the work. It's about being inspired by a book, a movie, a painting. My concern is that I would like artists to be able to talk honestly about their relationship to their sources without feeling like their legal situation is being jeopardized. Yeah, I think that's actually one problem. I don't want to get off topic with some of the blurred lines.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, is that if you need to think about only in terms of mocking or parodying, maybe satiring or just erasing the person on the other side, then that's a very kind of narrow understanding about what artists do. So what I argue in the paper is some notion that if what we're trying to get at with raw materials and actually transformative use more generally is creativity, then maybe we should just be asking whether the work is being used as part of the creative process. It's not going that does sweep a lot of, will probably sweep more uses within the umbrella of fair use than were before. But, I think that is asking the question that I think we're trying to get at, but for some reason we're hesitant about going there.
So more on the subjective intent of the person reusing the work and how they actually came to use the original. Is that my understanding you correctly?
Yeah. There is some controversy about whether a subjective intent test is the way to deal with fair use. I think that can be abused a bit, but looking at the artist's creative process to understand, get a sense about the who, what, where, when, and why of the process at issue. I do think that there's a possibility. Someone with a good lawyer will produce a better right. deposition testimony. But it's at least asking the right question. And my concern is that right now the courts are asking, are sympathetic. It seems to be increasingly sympathetic to the importance of fair use, but have a difficult time figuring out how to kind of best capture it.
Right.
Right. And they're not alone, because if the courts can't figure it out, then all of us who want to exercise our fair use rights have a really hard time figuring that out too. Shuba, what do you think about the notion of adding a subject, looking at the reuser's intent in doing so and adding that as a factor, or maybe replacing one of the other factors with that?
Right. No, I don't actually like it. I need to run off real quick though. Sorry about that. But just to answer your question, I really don't think courts are going to be able to gauge it. I mean, they try to do this in another area of copyright having to do with protection for designs, protection for industrial design, where there is a test to ask, well, did you make this sculpture as a sculpture, or did you make the sculpture so that it would serve as a bike rack? It's a famous bike rack case. Or did you make this armless figure to serve as a, kind of homage to Venus de Milo, or is it meant to be a dressmaker's dummy? And I just don't think those cases actually make much sense to me or they work. I would really just go back to the basics of copyright and really ask, first of all, whether the, you know, the alleged infringer's work really somehow undermines the creative process. I know that's a very broad question, but really look at it structurally as to whether it actually undermines the creative process that led to the original work, and also ask whether, you know, absent some sort of finding of fair use, I mean, I think this gets to Andrew's point about creative process, you know, really would have affected the creative process of the alleged infringer. So I'd really like the court to get a little bit deeper into really understanding how the works are made and really develop a record that way, rather than trying to gauge after the fact what the artist intended.
Can I jump in?
Let's let you jump in a second, Andrew. I know that Shuba needs to go catch a train, and we definitely don't want to have him miss his ride. Absolutely. So thank you so much for joining us, Shuba. It's been too short. We'll need to have you back fairly soon,
I really enjoyed it. Thank you again.
You too.
Bye, Shuba.
Thanks.
Bye, Andrew. Bye, Sarah. Bye.
Bye.
All right, Andrew, what were you going to say?
Sure. I mean, I totally agree with where Shuba's kind of endpoint, that we really need is a better sense of kind of how does copying harm the copyright holder. I think we're trying to use this, whether, you know, is it transformative enough to kind of do this line drawing between what's infringing, what's not infringing, but we don't have a great sense. I think this goes back to our early discussion about kind of what we're trying to protect in the first place, and whether the use at issue kind of actually creates some sort of cognizable or foreseeable harm to the creative process of the plaintiff. And I think that's ultimately where we're going to have to go. So I second his ultimately where he wants to go. And I think that's where the challenge for courts and scholars and all of us to focus going forward.
All right. So I think I'm going to go ahead and put our second MCLE passphrase in the show, since Andrew mentioned a moment ago that something was skewing in one direction. The only thing I've been able to think about is Zayn Malik or Malik, or I'm not sure how we pronounce his name, but he is going to be our second passphrase for the show in honor of his burgeoning solo career. And since we're moving into things musical, let's and we've already been talking about the Blurred Lines case, let's play our bumper for Hollywood and entertainment. Right. I don't know if there's too much to talk about here with Pandora, but I wanted to get into it with you, Andrew, because we're talking about, and we've discussed on the show and had music law experts on the show before, this ongoing dispute that Pandora is having regarding pre-1972 recordings. And it's too bad that we lost Shuba, because he has done some really interesting research and work and thought on the federal circuit, and I'm getting out into the legal weeds a little bit here, but basically the whole notion that there's a tension in general in United States law of the extent to which federal law and state laws play nicely with each other, and when federal law gets to trump state law, and when state laws get to trump federal law. And we're sort of getting into that issue here in this Pandora case because of the nature of the 1976 Copyright Act and the fact that state laws, according to Pandora, govern sound recordings from 1972 backward. And they say they get to play those songs without paying royalties. The record companies disagree, and much litigation, of course, is the result. So in one of these cases, and I think it may be the prominent one, it involves the Flo and Eddie, the artists from the Turtles, and the argument that Pandora floated there quite creatively from its Latham and Watkins lawyers did not all that surprisingly go well in the trial court, but they have the opportunity to appeal, and certainly they will. And the thing they tried is kind of in Andrew's wheelhouse because Andrew likes to study the interplay between copyright law and the First Amendment. And there are often interesting ways in which the two collide. And here's one of them. Pandora argued that in California and in various other states, we have an anti-SLAPP law. And what SLAPP stands for is Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. And what those laws are trying to prevent is someone filing a lawsuit against you, not because they really have a legitimate claim against you that they're dying to pursue, but because they want to stop your speech. And so that's what Pandora came in and argued here, that that the record companies, by preventing them from distributing pre-1972 music, were inhibiting their free speech rights. So they lost, Andrew. Do you think they have a prayer on appeal?
I think they have a prayer, but probably not because of not because of their First Amendment rights. This is actually a pretty interesting case for a bunch of reasons. If you're a CivPro geek, if you're a copyright geek, this says there's also, and if you're a music fan, there's lots for you here.
Yes.
So first issue, there's no question that federal copyright law does not apply to pre-1972 sound recordings. It's an express carve out in the copyright statute. State law does apply here, but the nature of state law state copyright law is very murky in California and elsewhere. So there's this question about what does state copyright law protect for these pre-1972 works that are carved out? The district court did looked at the statutory text in California, looked at a few of the cases that were there, and said, there does seem to be this public performance right for sound recordings in California, even though it definitely gets there through a bunch of implications, some inferences and some canons of statutory interpretation. There isn't a clear. I don't think there's a clear answer to this question. We know if it was for post 1972 works, there's no general post 1972 sound recordings. Federal law does provide this public performance right in the context of only digital transmissions, not for over the air AM/FM broadcasts. But for state law, it's unclear. So we're dealing here with the question about whether. The Turtles and other 60s artists, 50s and 60s recording artists can get under state law what they can't get under federal law. And it's important to note that this anti-SLAPP motion is something that's only available when you're dealing with California state law. This case was filed in, I think, December. Pandora filed this anti-SLAPP motion a couple months later, and we have a ruling on this basically First Amendment question within 3 months. You would never get that in federal court because you have to deal with motion to dismiss or summary judgment. There isn't this procedural device to allow defendants to dismiss copyright lawsuits early. So it's interesting to me that you get an anti-SLAPP motion in a copyright case because you're dealing with state law. So that being said, if you are Pandora, you're probably not happy about this case because the statutory interpretation says, okay, there does seem to be in California a state law right for sound recordings to publicly perform the works. But there's an interesting part of the case of the decision that does say, the speech the activities that are being challenged here are in furtherance of Pandora's free speech rights. So although they aren't, producing any of the music that they're streaming themselves, the court says there is this protected right to broadcast entertainment to the public. Interesting to me, the court rejected the argument that, copyright infringement is not protected speech. It says
those are, it says that actually conflates two questions. It conflates the question about whether there is a First Amendment, there's a protected activity in the broadcast, with the question about whether that protected activity can be the basis for liability. So there's a lot going on in this case. Don't really know. I'm not sure what the Ninth Circuit will do with it on the question of what the state law requires. But honestly, I'm not really sure that there is a good solution to this dispute that involves either that does involve either there being no state rights to sound recordings, or that you're gonna legislatively we would have to kind of apply the federal regime back to 1972. So I'm not really sure that the kind of working on this through courts is going to ultimately resolve the concern on any side. This is a federal law question. It should be, but there are some interesting geeky things happening here in the meantime.
Yeah, definitely. I also think it's interesting and somewhat ironic that from a former trial court litigator standpoint, I have to admire what Pandora tried here. And it's funny that what they tried was the SLAPP law, which is strategic lawsuits against public participation, because everything Pandora is doing here is very strategic. This was sort of a swing for the fence to see if they could get a judge to bite on throwing the case out under the SLAPP law. And by no real skin off their nose, if they win that, that's fabulous. If they don't, then they get to appeal it and possibly wind up in court with a different judge, which I think that they would like to have happen in this case. So it's good tactics in any event to give it a try. Sarah, any thoughts about this?
Well, I don't know. I think I must be missing something because I was really confused by the anti-SLAPP. I mean, so what is the argument just that, this copyright lawsuit is an attempt to restrict their speech in the name of copyright? I don't understand how that's different from any other copyright lawsuit. I guess I was lost on where the SLAPP part came in. Where's the free speech argument that's different from other copyright cases?
So what's unusual here is that most copyright cases are almost always now brought in federal court. Federal court under federal law. The anti-SLAPP provisions only apply to state law claims, and it's rare that we'll have a state copyright law claim. You actually will see a lot of the right of publicity cases will be dealt with on an anti-SLAPP motion, because there you're dealing with a state IP law that is challenging a movie or a video game. This avenue of dealing with getting a potentially quick resolution of the case that is immediately appealable is available for other forms of state IP. It's just very rare in copyright because we're dealing with federal law, and there's no federal anti-SLAPP protections, although there have been a number of people who have suggested that maybe we should have something like this in the federal law.
Right. So people are bringing them for just any, I guess I thought of anti-SLAPP as being about a lawsuit that prevents something that's like, what you think of as like First Amendment speech, like something critical, for example, or commentary, not just not having to pay royalties on a song. I mean, that to me, that just, that's the part I guess I'm missing. Yeah. But
Andrew, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I'm gleaning from your earlier comments are that although they may have lost on this motion to get it tossed out early, they still have freedom of speech things to talk about. Probably not with the Court of Appeal, because that's just going to deal with the SLAPP questions. Although they're going to have to articulate to the Court of Appeal their speech interests there. But also, assuming it comes back down and trial resumes, that they're going to have some speech arguments to make that have to do with their act of selecting music and broadcasting it, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I don't ultimately think that's going to be what they'll
what the case is going to be resolved on. You know, I don't think there's a great, I'm not really sure what the fair use argument is here. I think what they were saying in this motion is that we have enough of a free speech interest to be able to use this procedural device. And what the court says, yes, what the court said that, yes, you do have enough of a free speech interest to get past to use this motion, but you don't actually have a strong enough case on the merits to win it.
Okay. Let's take a break, because Andrew was telling me before the show that he, too, is a Blue Apron customer. So we have to thank our second sponsor for the show, Blue Apron. And Andrew, before I get in and start glowingly talking about my experiences with Blue Apron, why don't you tell us about yours?
So my plan for tonight is to have a short rib burger on a pretzel bun with sweet potato fries on the side, all delivered by Blue Apron. I'm very excited.
All of the food from Blue Apron is just so amazing. I've had a few good adventures with Blue Apron lately. Last night made their spicy Thai noodle chicken noodle soup, which if I can just speak to the parents out there for a moment who struggle with getting their youngsters to expand their palates at all. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for helping out with that, because I'm able to just sort of present this to my child. There's my version of the Thai chicken noodle soup that we made last night. And, you know, my son asks what's for dinner, and I say, oh, we're having Thai pasta, because he'll eat pasta. And sure enough, he just absolutely wolfed down two bowls of this stuff. It was so delicious. And I went heavy on the curry paste too. That's wonderful thing about Blue Apron is you know, if you're not into spicy food, you can go lighter or heavier, and they tell you exactly when in their recipes that you should think about going easy if you don't like things quite so spicy. But I went all in on the red curry paste last night, and because I like things spicy, and so does my kid generally, but his comment was, this is so good, but it's a bit strong. So I might have overdone it just a tad, given the fact that it was very heavy on garlic and ginger too. But so delicious. We really loved this dish. And then the other thing I've made recently was lamb and beef shawarma with a creamy radish salad. And this was basically like two separate meals. There's the shawarma on the left and the salad on the right. And then I think I have another picture of just the salad, which really was just could have been a great meal in its own right. But of course you need to add some protein, et cetera. But it was just, I guess my point is that the food is so good and the portions are so generous. We actually, despite the fact that my son and I wolfed through our Thai chicken noodle soup last night and each had second helpings, there's still enough left over for at least one person to have lunch today. So it's really a wonderful combination of flavors they always provide. The ability to just sort of expand your kids' horizons. My son also wolfed through the shawarma and creamy radish salad because, of course, I'm able to present this as, think of it as like a Greek taco. And, yeah. You know, it went over great. And tacos I can sell any day of the week. So it's wonderful for that. I recently had the chance to give some Blue Apron meals to a friend of mine who'd never heard of doing this kind of thing before, and they just absolutely adored it. She has a family of four, and actually she got the flu right after I presented her with her Blue Apron box, and that worked out perfectly because her husband whipped up the short rib burgers on a pretzel bun with hoppy cheddar sauce. And he was just so blown away that he was able to put together this meal so easily and deliciously. And it you know, made it wonderful for my friend who did not feel like dragging herself out of bed to cook. And now tonight she's going to make the Thai chicken noodle soup, which hopefully will help her cold. So thank you so much, Blue Apron. We hope that you guys are trying it out. You really, really should. There's no reason not to, because if you go to blueapron.com/twit, you're going to get two of these great meals for free to try it out on your own. Now, you will want to go and see if you are in their delivery area. Both coasts of the U.S. are covered pretty well. You just have to go to their map and check it out and see if your zip code qualifies. I know we've had some Texas listeners that are going, no, when are we going to get Blue Apron too? So hang in there, Texas. I think you're coming, and other parts of the middle of the United States may have to wait a bit. But definitely check it out. See if you are eligible. And then blueapron.com/twit will get you two free meals. It will get us recognition for having turned you on to this wonderful service. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for the delicious meals, for my son's enhanced culinary palate, and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's move on and talk about some things on the legislation and policy front. Right before the show, I was chatting with folks in IRC, as I am wont to do, and there was a case they definitely wanted us to get into that I hadn't planned talking about today, but it is a fairly interesting continuation of our discussion of contract law. We were just talking about the interplay between state and federal law, and Shuba has written a great piece on that that's in our discussion points if you want to check it out, talking about the Federal Circuit, which is the court that makes all of our patent law in the United States, and its deference to state contract law. And one of the instances, not just, in the copyright front we were talking about with Pandora, this comes up across the board, this state versus federal law, which controls question. And it comes up in the contract context too. One thing that happened this week is that The Verge got its hands on some Amazon employee contracts that had to do specifically with temporary warehouse workers. And The Verge rightly noticed and paid attention to the fact that there is an 18-month non-compete clause included in those contracts, which is obviously bumming these employees out, because say you have a 3-month temporary stint working in an Amazon warehouse at $12 an hour or what have you. And then you leave and you have to go work somewhere else like Sam's Club or, you know, wherever else your skills are portable to. If you have an 18-month non-compete after your employment with Amazon concludes, you're going to be in a world of hurt. And the reason that I bring up this contract federalism question is I scarcely pay attention to non-compete provisions anymore, because in California, where I am, they are not enforceable and have not been enforceable for a long time, except in very limited circumstances that would not apply here. So I think it's a pretty interesting question of the way that the law gets applied and different states doing different things. And then if you have this, as Andrew was discussing earlier, if you have a dispute like this, a contract issue like this coming up in a federal court, how that might play into things too. So I'm going to toss this out to you, Andrew, and see if you have any thoughts on the non-compete issue.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the terms right now, I mean, who is not a competitor of something that Amazon sells? It's extremely broadly worded. I'd be shocked. Even if a state would enforce non-competes more generally, this is so broad that it strikes me as creating some real restraints on employment, particularly for folks who I presume aren't coming to the job with some sort of particular knowledge that will make the company that will sort of advance the company's interests. This seems just kind of a naked restraint on people's ability to get other jobs. So it seems really, really problematic. In California, this would be an unlawful business practice. But know, not everywhere is California, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. And we were also talking before the show, and I was trying to see if there had been any resolution to another non-compete that Amazon is testing out in the Washington courts that involved someone who was not a warehouse worker, but some more white-collar job where the worker left and went to Google. And they were attempting to enforce their non-compete. Of course, they're attempting to enforce it in the state of Washington because here in California, they would not be able to do that. The person who wrote this up at The Verge is Spencer Woodman. Did a very good job of pulling out the language in question and really getting into the implications of all of this, including the fact that there's generally a reasonableness standard that would be applied to contracts like this. So as Andrew was saying, if this just really goes off the deep end in limiting people from being able to find subsequent employment, whether in its length or the fact that everyone is a competitor to Amazon, there is actually language in this agreement that attempts to address that reasonableness standard by the contract also having the employers agree that each and every covenant and restraint in the agreement is reasonable. So trying to jump through that hurdle. But again, I don't know that a court would necessarily look kindly on this kind of thing, even though these are not the kinds of contracts that we're usually taking to task on this show. Those kinds of contracts are the ones that no one ever reads, the ones that you automatically click online. And this is a slightly different situation. You would think that, and I think courts often think that people in an employment context might actually read their contract and might actually take to heart the admonitions that they're given when they're told you should really have a lawyer take a look at this. But still, when you're talking about a warehouse employee on the one hand and Amazon on the other, you can see that they are not in equal bargaining positions and there might be room for a court to question that. Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, I would think that that's definitely true. I mean, even though I think California is the only state that's gone so far as to just have a blanket prohibition, I don't know, but I assume that lots of states would want there to be some tie to actual probable harm to the employer. And it's really hard to see how that would be the case for like warehouse workers, for example. Like you said, it seems more like a naked restraint. It definitely seems problematic from a public policy standpoint to me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, so if that's, we really don't know what's going to happen with this. As far as I know, there's not a lawsuit pending about it. The only lawsuit that's pending, if it is still pending, is the one that was filed last year by Amazon in Washington. This is just sort of a scoop that The Verge got and shed some light on the fact that these clauses are in the contract and basically threw out a big WTF about it. It's something to look at. Certainly, it seems likely that someone will test it in a state other than California and see if they're going to be able to, you know, make this clause go away or be found by a court to be unenforceable. Would you expect that to happen, Andrew, that perhaps some workers' rights group might come along and help someone pursue a lawsuit? Because that's the thing this article points out, and that is fairly obvious, that if you are the person on the receiving end of the non-compete clause, you might have a difficult time testing it in court.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but it doesn't sound like the worst idea for a class action lawsuit. I mean, you have, I assume there's a large number of workers who are, mm-hmm. have a difficult time bringing in their own case. And if it's all the same terms in every contract, it's not I could see that happening as a result of this, but I don't want to encourage too much.
Right. We call them taco suits. And I've kind of forgotten why we call them taco suits, but I think it was a Taco Bell class action lawsuit that gave that moniker to the non-well-founded class action that often finds its way into our discussion. I agree with you. I don't know that this would necessarily be that. And it does seem like this kind of provision, a non-compete, a binding arbitration clause. These are all things that are lurking in contracts everywhere that people should just be paying attention to if they're not lawyers, that they can. It's not just like clicking I agree. You should definitely pay attention to these terms because they can impact your life if you're not careful. Any final thoughts on this, Sarah?
No, I mean, although on the other hand, just to push back a little bit on what you're saying, it's and you touched on this earlier, but will these employees really have any, even if they read it, what can they do? I mean, if mm-hmm. they don't have a lot of negotiating power in the situation, it's more of a public policy issue than it is an individual, to me at least, than it is more like an individual responsibility issue. But
right.
Maybe that's the bleeding heart liberal in me. I don't know.
No, I agree. And I tend to be fairly bleeding heart myself if people are not capable of discerning that from the things I say. I agree. There's very little that an employee could do. Although I do, from time to time, represent employees who are changing jobs and who need to look through all the fine print. And again, it's generally not the warehouse worker who's able to hire a lawyer to do that and then push back. But that's how the system is supposed to work, that, you know, in theory, people are supposed to be able to accomplish that task and come back and say, hey, you know, I really don't like this clause. Can we negotiate it? Can we change it a bit? Can we throw it out altogether? And in this situation, that just might not even be practical.
Right.
All right. Also on the policy and legislation front, just to note, I really don't have much to add to the fact we knew the other shoe would drop on net neutrality and the challenges would be imminent. Yes, indeed. Just so you know that's happening. The first lawsuit has been filed and there will likely be more. So we'll continue to follow those and see if anything interesting comes from a court at some point talking about the new net neutrality rules. No one's surprised that lawsuits were forthcoming. In fact, I think the huge surprise would have been if none were forthcoming. Any thoughts on this, Andrew?
Nope. No surprises.
All right. Sarah?
No, it sounded like the only surprise, at least according to the articles, was that they were filed so fast, because usually it doesn't happen until they're published in the Federal Register. And I don't know enough about administrative law to know, but apparently there's some work that that they think at least allows them to start suing now. But I don't know enough. I'm not an expert in that area, but it sounds like that's the only surprise here.
Right. A couple of shows ago, we highlighted an article that had all the deadlines for filing, and they certainly were not now. So we'll have to see. Maybe that's a reason for tossing out some of the early suits, but eventually courts will be looking at the net neutrality rules for sure. Let's see, where should we go next? I think we should talk about Walker, not Texas Ranger, and some more First Amendment stuff with Andrew. So I think we have a new bumper First Amendment stuff.
That's a dramatic bumper.
We have some new and dramatic bumpers thanks to our intern Sando. And now we have bumpers for everything. So I kind of feel like Conan O'Brien when he's doing his video blog on his show and he just pushes the button and the computer plays a bumper. I feel like I should have just like a big red button for my bumpers. But they do that in the studio. So it's Victor who gets to push the big red button. All right, let's talk about license plates and sports teams. And let's tie this in, if we can, with technology law, since that's ostensibly what the show is about. And I think we can tie it in because really what we're on the verge of discussing here is trademarks and free speech, and they apply across the board, whether you're talking about license plates or sports teams or something that you're doing online. So the interesting thing that's happening in Texas, they can't get Blue Apron, and we're wondering if they're going to be able to get a Confederate flag on their license plate. There is a group there, and I'm not sure what the process is for getting your little symbol on a state's license plate. I know here in California, we like museums get Snoopy. If you're giving a portion of your license registration fee to support museums, you can get a Snoopy on your license plate. You can get a lovely whale's flukes going into the water if you're supporting save the ocean kinds of causes. So I'm not sure exactly which one, obviously. So here in Texas, there is a group that would like Sons of Confederate Veterans flag and symbol on the license plate. Texas does not want that on there, rightly guessing that a lot of people would be upset by that. So the dispute ensues. Andrew, how do you think this is going to come out?
I am not totally sure. I mean, the Supreme Court seems... So this argument was this was before the Supreme Court today, and the question is whether, you know, first whether these license plates are government speech or whether they are the speech of the private organization, the Sons of Confederate Veterans.
Or couldn't they ostensibly also be the speech of the driver? Because you can pick whether you want the whale right. or the Snoopy or the Confederate flag.
Yeah, so it would. It comes down to basically whether, you know, if it's government speech, the government can say whatever it wants. And the question is whether, okay, maybe it's not government speech. This is actually some sort of forum for private speech. And if it's a forum for private speech, then the government can't sort of make distinctions between viewpoints that it favors and viewpoints that it does not. Here it does seem like, I mean, so I don't think there's really much of a question that there is a viewpoint discrimination going on here, and just the question is whether there is a forum here for people to kind of express their desires and views. I tend to come out on the side of I hate to say it, on the side of the Sons of Confederate Veterans in terms of their argument. As objectionable as the symbol might be, Texas has, my understanding is that any nonprofit group can submit an application so long as it meets some technical requirements. And you're willing to pay for it, they'll produce a license plate, with this narrow exception for whether the license is offensive or to in some sort of a foreseeable way. I think we want to be careful about the government sort of making the distinctions about who gets to express their messages and who doesn't. And I suspect that there will be multiple justices on the court who are going to be sympathetic to that view.
Right. So in IRC, people are wondering, so if the Confederate flag is okay, would a swastika be okay too? Is there some kind of limit you think that the state should put on this form of speech, whoever's speech it is?
Yeah, so, I mean, the government could close the forum. They could if they need to make these distinctions, they don't have to have this program. It is... designed, my understanding is that it's revenue generating, that people will pay $1,000 or something like that to get this license plate made. And if you're going to open it up for that sort of purpose, then, you know, in this argument about the swastika, and I think jihad came up in the debate, unfortunately, that's kind of it may just come with the territory. So, you know, as much as, you know, I like those jumping dolphins and stuff, you know, it's ultimately, you know, an opportunity for people to express their message in the government, whether it's, you know, billboards or bus stops or license plates. If you're going to have a revenue generating scheme to allow people to express their message, you know, First Amendment puts limits on how much you can limit that form.
Right. I did kind of bury the lead on this. This is a case called Walker versus Sons of Confederate Veterans that was argued this week before the Supreme Court, as Andrew pointed out. Sarah, what do you think about all this?
I mean, I think Andrew makes a very compelling argument. My initial reaction was it feels like a driver's license or a license plate conveys some sort of stamp of government approval. So to me, the argument that it's some sort of government speech or at least connection to the government seems like that intuitively made sense to me. But you know, hearing Andrew argue about it being a public forum and people can put whatever they want on there, that also makes sense. But I don't know. To me, I guess my initial reaction was, yeah, of course it's the state has some say in it, because if I saw a license plate with a Confederate flag, I would have, you know, in Texas, on a Texas plate, I would associate that with the state, not just the driver, because they are, mm-hmm. they have some hand in creating it. So maybe that just means that they need to shut down the vanity plate option. I don't know. But that was my kind of gut reaction to it.
Right.
Yeah, the ACLU refers to this as hybrid speech, that there is, you know, the selection of what goes on it comes from private actors, but there still is a literal stamping from the government. They're actually are involved in the manufacturing process. So this case is pretty interesting to the extent that it requires the court to have to kind of figure out how to draw lines when you really are dealing with hybrid speech, and whether you kind of lean in favor of the kind of traditional public forum analysis, or whether we're dealing with something different, and whether the government has kind of some wiggle room in terms of viewpoint discrimination. I do think it's a close call.
Can I ask you hypothetically, here the state seems to be trying to distance itself from this private group that wants the symbol on the license plate. Picking up on a thread you mentioned a moment ago, if it's the government's speech, it's not, there's not a First Amendment problem. What if the state had gone the other way? Here, Governor Rick Perry, as this article says, perhaps still smarting from the revelation of a family hunting camp whose name included a racial slur, said the plates should be rejected. Suppose the government or the governor felt otherwise and the state felt otherwise and, you know, loved the Confederate past of the South and thought that, you know, has a nostalgic attachment to it and thinks it's perfectly fine. But other people in the state felt otherwise and wanted to challenge it. Would they have a First Amendment basis for doing so?
Probably not, so long as the contrary message could also be approved. So mm-hmm. the idea is that if you object to a pro-Confederate message being allowed through the form, and you're perfectly free to have a anti-Confederate message on there. If Texas were mm-hmm. to reject that the latter message, then it would have some real in some ways a very similar argument, but from a very different kind of political perspective. So it really depends on whether there's distinctions being made between two different viewpoints and whether that can be proven.
Okay, so we're talking about government speech issues here. How does this come up in the Washington Redskins kerfuffle?
Yeah, right. So interestingly, a similar argument, actually also by the ACLU, is being made that the federal government in setting up a trademark registry can't make
a distinction between Marx that it finds offensive, immoral, and disparaging versus those that it does. So basically, you guys argued that you open up a forum for speech. You can apply for a trademark, and therefore the government can't make these distinctions between whether your football mascot is offensive or not. And the argument against that is, again, that, oh, well, trademark or trademark registration is it's to some extent government speech. It's the government saying you have all these additional protections for your mark so long as you meet these requirements. And I suspect that the given that the ACLU is making very similar arguments, that what happens in this the Walker case will have some bearing upon how we think about the First Amendment issues in the Washington football dispute.
All right. Well, we will definitely await the Supreme Court's finding, determination, and opinion on this. Sarah, any final thoughts before we move on?
No, I don't think so. Just interesting stuff. I hadn't really thought about the parallel to the Redskins case. And I guess I didn't realize that part of the argument on the government side there was that the granting of a trademark constitutes government speech. But I can see that same kind of argument of it gives the impression, at least, of a government stamp of approval. So maybe that does make sense. I don't know. It's interesting.
It is. And trust me, I think there is a tech and or online communication tie in here in that trademarks can be granted for anything and for everything you want to do online. All right, let's move on to a terms of service issue and learn how what happens in bankruptcy doesn't necessarily stay in bankruptcy. Don't you just love the new bumpers? All right. So here, the term of service in question was Radio Shacks. And the poor shack, it's having to close locations. It's going through bankruptcy proceedings, but it's also selling customer information as part, you know, it's an asset. And that's what you do in bankruptcy. Anybody have a problem with that? Sarah?
I haven't read the privacy policy, but it seems problematic. It's if the term really said in the privacy policy, we will not sell your data. And there was no carve out for what happens if the business goes under, it seems like it's an obvious violation. I think there's probably more nuance to it than that though, but that's from a superficial standpoint, it definitely seems problematic. It sounded
right,
like,
what happens more often than not is that buried in the fine print that no one reads is the ability to sell your data if the company goes under, or even if it doesn't go under, if it gets sold, if that asset gets transferred one way or another. It's not too surprising to me that that's what's going on here. Again, I have not delved into the legalese here and seen exactly what Radio Shack is, if it's going back on representations that it made to customers. Do you know the answer to that, Andrew, or is this just sort of a course of business thing that's happening?
Yeah, I don't know the specific terms that are being used. My understanding is that the Federal Trade Commission will allow... has allowed sort of some wiggle room here, so long as the information, the data is being purchased by along with other assets, it will generally be used in the same line of business, and that the privacy protections are generally upheld. That the FTC will allow that to go forward. So it sounds like there's my understanding that there's generally is some relatively robust oversight of these issues, and that this is definitely going to be on the radar, and that the FTC has blocked the sale of data in the past. And I don't know whether this is going to be one of those cases or not.
Yeah, so back to Texas. Texas is one of the state attorney generals challenging this. Also Tennessee. where in Texas it's a violation of its law to sell identifying information when a company's privacy statement says that it will refrain from doing so. So presumably Radio Shack had a statement that did that at some point. But you think that the FTC might look past that, Andrew?
My understanding is that they've settled with other bankrupt companies in the past to give some ability for them to sell off their assets, but still protect consumers. I think sometimes they'll require consent or put other conditions on the sale. I don't know enough about the collection practices here or the terms to sort of weigh in definitively about what Texas will. I am always wary to say what Texas will or will not do.
Right. It's exactly. It's a really good reminder too that there's probably very little reason for places like Radio Shack to have a whole lot of personal information about you. I know that every time, you know, it's kind of like carrying around a roll of duct tape to put over computer cameras that you're sitting in front of. And maybe it sounds a little paranoid, but every time a store is asking me for my name, address, and birth date, you know, I just decline. And I hope that people are out there doing that, because otherwise, you know, why do you need to go in and buy that charger at Radio Shack and have them have all your personal information to sell in bankruptcy someday? It just seems like a bad idea to go around giving your information to stores when that can happen. Sarah, any other thoughts on this?
Well, although if you're buying online, there's kind of no option unless you have it sent. I actually have a friend who has stuff sent to a store, actually, so that he doesn't have to give his address in those situations. But if you buy online, which I do almost for everything, all of these stores have all of my information just by default.
That's an excellent point. I was sort of, you know, Amazon, of course, knows every single thing about every single thing I do, but Radio Shack might not.
Good point.
Yeah. All right. So let us move on to our tip and resources of the week. Our tip, I mentioned on our last show that we have this wonderful resource, Sarah, with us on a weekly basis. So I thought we'd start giving out some tips related to Creative Commons. Creative Commons, if you weren't able to glean from our earlier discussion or have just never heard of it and are still kind of struggling with what we were talking about earlier, is this wonderful licensing strategy that was put in place. Is it 10 years ago now?
Yeah, it's more than that, I think.
It's more than that. Yeah.
12 or something like that. Yeah.
Wow. Yes. Time flies. but it is a great way if you are a creator make sure that your works reach a wide audience. And it is a great way if you are a creator who wants to use something culturally resonant or just doesn't want to use, for example, stock photography. You might be able to find something that you could use that has a Creative Commons license associated with it. So I think for our first series of Creative Commons tips, Sarah, I'd like to ask you, hey, I think a work that I want to use is Creative Commons licensed. What do I do next?
Sure. So ideally, the item will say which of the six types of the license is applied to it. That is not always the case. Sometimes you'll see something that just says Creative Commons licensed. And that's unfortunate because there are actually six different versions. And then there's also the CC0 tool, which we kind of talked about a little bit with the SpaceX, which is basically a public domain dedication. But in terms of the licenses, I think six can seem overwhelming and sounds complicated, but it's actually pretty simple. So all of the licenses require attribution. So if you're reusing the work, you have to name the author, link to the work, include a copyright notice if there is one. And all of the attribution requirements are subject to kind of a reasonableness standard. So depending on the context in which you're using the work, that kind of dictates how you give attribution. So you have some flexibility there. In terms of the other license elements and what the different licenses means, it comes down to three things. So one, does the license allow commercial use? So we have these NC licenses, we call them, which are non-commercial purposes only. I mean, it means that you can only use the work for non-commercial purposes. We also have licenses that don't allow derivatives to be made, and those are called the ND or no derivs licenses. And there are a couple of those, which just mean that you can just use the work as is. You can do anything, but you can't create an adaptation of it. And then for those licenses that do allow derivatives to be made, there are some that are called our share alike licenses, which require that you have to, that if you make a derivative, you have to offer that derivative under the same license. And so that's kind of, that's the, our version of a copyleft, like free software, for content. So basically it runs the gamut from the most restrictive, which is our license that's called, for the terminology we use is by NCND, which means attribution, non-commercial, no derivs, which allows you to only use the work for verbatim use for non-commercial purposes, all the way to the least restrictive, which is the attribution license, which allows you to do anything with the work for any purpose as long as you attribute the author.
Something that Andrew said earlier in the show resonates here, and that is that copyright law doesn't require attribution necessarily. Fair use, for example, doesn't require attribution if you're making all the fair use factors. So one great way to make sure that you're getting attribution is to use a CC license, because they add that in on all of them.
That's right. Although if somebody is making a use of a fair use of a CC licensed work, they don't actually have to attribute, because the CC license doesn't apply if copyright doesn't apply. But a lot of people still do attribute just because it's a nice thing to do and it helps to know where it comes from. So,
I think there's some overlap too, isn't there, between say you are doing something that would otherwise be a fair use and it's a Creative Commons licensed work, you might give the attribution or do whatever other attributes of the license are, just to make sure, just not to have any uncertainty about your fair use, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. When I worked at Stanford, actually, on the documentary film project, we advised documentary filmmakers about fair use questions. And when there was any doubt, like it was a kind of an edgy case, we would suggest using CC licensed video or photos or whatever it was, because then you're safe. So it is a nice kind of cushion to fair use in that respect.
Great. Well, we have, thank you so much for our first Creative Commons tip. We'll have more coming your way in future shows. We have a couple of resources for you this week, but before we get to them, I want to thank our final sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. FreshBooks is the cloud accounting software designed from the ground up for entrepreneurs, small businesses, and it is perfect for attorneys. In fact, I use it myself. It is exactly what I use to keep track of my time and bill clients, and it makes that process just beautifully streamlined and easy, automated in situations where it can be. I don't need to use a watch to keep track of my time anymore. All I have to do is open up the FreshBooks app on my phone, start the timer while I'm working, and it automatically captures that time and has it ready to go into an invoice when it's time to do that. It's built for growing businesses. On average, FreshBooks customers double their revenue in the first 24 months and get paid an average of 5 days faster. That's because the invoices look beautiful. They're very professional. They go out very cleanly. Via email, you have the option to do regular mail invoices if that is something that a particular client needs. But I find that email invoicing, you know, it arrives in the inbox and it goes straight to accounting and you get paid. It's a great way to go. If you're still using Word or Excel or Google Docs to create invoices, you really need to try FreshBooks because it looks so much more professional. You've got your own letterhead, logo, what have you, branding in there, and it just works like a charm. You can avoid those awkward emails and phone calls to your late paying clients because there's an automated late payment reminder you can activate if you have somebody that needs a little nudge to make sure that your payment's in the mail. You can set up recurring profiles. And so things that you do every single month, you know that that's just something you need to bill for. You put that on autopilot and it's ready to go when you need it. You're going to spend less time on paperwork. You're going to free up to 2 days per month, perhaps, to focus on either the work that you want to do or the playing that you want to do when you're not working. It's great just to have the extra time. Don't keep your receipts in a shoebox anymore. We're coming up on tax time real quick here. Instead, snap photos of your receipts right from your phone. That's going to capture your expenses. They're going to immediately go out and be included in the invoices to your clients. Your financial reports are there and available for you too, already for April 15th, which is right around the corner. FreshBooks integrates with your apps. If you're a Google app person, PayPal, Stripe, MailChimp, Fundbox, Zen Payroll, and more. And if you ever need help, you're going to talk to a real person every time, and support is free forever. So try FreshBooks right now for free with no obligation. Start your 30-day trial by going to freshbooks.com/twill. And don't forget to enter This Week in Law when they ask how you heard about us. That helps us a great deal. And FreshBooks helps us out a great deal by supporting This Week in Law. Thank you, FreshBooks. And so we've got a couple of cool resources for you. One I put in getting ready to do the show with Shubha Ghosh. He, I believe, is involved in teaching at least some of the courses at the MOOCs at Madison, the massively online, massively open online courses is what MOOCs stands for. And these are wonderful courses on all different topics with great professors like Shubha that you might be interested in pursuing. So if you look up the MOOCs at Madison, you will find everything that's available at Wisconsin to help you become better educated about an array of topics. So definitely check that out. And then something else to check out is something called scoop.com. It's made for journalists, but for folks who listen to this show, I'm sure you could find a use for something that provides a simple and free search interface that lets you simultaneously search the patent office. That's grants and applications, no trademarks yet. The SEC, and soon federal court records. And then you can set alerts so that when a company that you follow files or receives a patent grant or makes an application, you're going to get notified immediately. That's something called Scoop, S-Q-O-O-P.com. So check that out. They have a beta at beta.scoop.com. It is in beta, so be aware of that. Otherwise, you can sign up at their main site, scoop.com, for more information about when the non-beta product is available. So with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. It's been a very fun one. I've learned a lot. Had some great discussions and had my mind opened, as is frequently the case when we talk about things like the intersection of copyright law and the First Amendment. Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us to help us better understand those issues.
Good. Thanks for having me. This is fun.
It's been a pleasure. Tell us if there's anything going on at Stanford or anything that you want to let people know that's up and coming on your calendar that they should be aware of.
Nothing that I can think of. There's always lots of stuff going on in law and tech here. So go to that website and it's easy to find the law and technology offerings here.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us. Thank you, Sarah, for coming back on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was a fun show. And Andrew, I really, really enjoyed your article. So I'll be anxious to see where is it published? I didn't notice what journal or...
It's coming out sometime later this year, Georgetown Law Journal.
Awesome.
And I would love to hear your thoughts. It's still in draft form, so plenty of time to add and alter let it be the raw material for you. There we go.
Ah, cool. I may take you up on that. I really thought it was really thought-provoking. So
thank you.
There you go. And you can check out Andrew's draft article yourself and everything else we've discussed today by going to our Delicious page, delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/297 is this episode of the show. If you've joined us today live, thank you so much. We record this show at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, and always in front of a live audience, which is always a joy to have you jump in IRC with us and play along with us during the show. Send us your comments and questions, etc., as we're doing the show. If you can't do that, then you should still keep the comments, questions, suggestions, etc. coming. You can reach Sarah. She's Sarah P at twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Email is always a great way to go. If not, you can reach us on Twitter. Let's see. I am D Howell on Twitter. Had to think about that. Sarah is S Hinch Pearson on Twitter. And we've got a Facebook page for the show and a Google Plus page. Those are great places to talk with us a bit more at length. If you want to kick off a discussion, those are good places to do it. There is a Google community as well for the show. I'm always flirting with whether we need a subreddit for the show. So if you have thoughts about that, or maybe want to help out with it, we do have, I think the, you know, whatever we would need from Reddit to have a subreddit for the show. I've just never fired one up. So send me your thoughts about that. If you'd like to talk about that further, that might be a great way for people to send us story suggestions and guest suggestions and everything else. But there are all kinds of ways to communicate with us already, so please use them. Also, if you want to find where all the shows are, you're not able to listen live, go to twit.tv/twill, and you'll find our whole archive there. We're also in the iTunes store, on YouTube, on Roku, various other places that you can also find from the twit.tv show page. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you next week on This Week in Law.